Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
We went to Kikori, where it rained and rained and rained, and everything became mildewed, and the food was ghastly, all out of a tin. But the only fresh food we had was bacon. We had a ship, if you could call it a ship, a little schooner that came once in 6 weeks, and there was no communication whatever apart from that. By the time the food arrived, a crate of potatoes would be nothing but skins and cockroaches. Anything that wasn't sealed up in a tin would be mouldy and horrible.
It was a bit frightening at times. Daisy would be away on patrol for weeks at a time. We had a mad prisoner in the jail that was in for rape, and he used to go mad every full moon, and he always escaped out of the jail on the full moon, and there'd be a great panic. Hadid had escaped, and all the police would be called out, and they'd eventually find him. He'd never get terribly far away, but it was always a bit frightening with no doors on the house to know that there's a rapist escaped every full moon.
Living on a plantation for a woman can be quite idyllic. In my case, I was only 26 miles from Madang, on a beautiful setting right on the Bismarck Sea, a large house designed for the tropics, letting all the sea breezes through, somebody to look after the house. It's really an idyllic existence.
Wife and Mrs. is the first of two programs on Australian women and children in Papua New Guinea. Despite the fact that European women invariably had servants to do their housework and gardening, running a household in remote and lonely outposts was a far cry from gracious living on an idyllic plantation. From the earliest days of Australian settlement in Papua New Guinea, many women, often with small children, went with their husbands to carve out new plantations or staff remote government outposts. Dr. Hank Nelson.
The first white people to settle permanently on the Papua New Guinea mainland came as a family. In 1874, the Reverend William Laws of the London Missionary Society, his wife Fanny, and their son arrived in Port Moresby. They moved into a four-roomed, verandaed house, and when the ship that brought them had sailed, they were the only white people on all of the south coast. Later, Mrs. Laws was to be praised for setting Papuans what was called an admirable object lesson in family living. That was her expected role, and she paid a high price to play it. Her second son was the first white child born in Port Moresby. 18 months later, wasted by fever, he was the first white child in the cemetery. Mission women, as wives, teachers, nurses and nuns, continued to be one of the main groups of foreign women in Papua New Guinea. But the largest group of women was always those defined by the census takers as wives without gainful employment. Many were to know the harrowing trials of Mrs. Laws as they tried to bring up their own families, like Elsie Champion.
I'd like to tell you how I went to Yeoma. My daughter was born in Port Moresby, and Ivan was at Yeoma. And, of course, you know, Yeoma, it was called the... What was it called?
White Man's Grave.
White Man's Grave. And she was premature. But when she was 9 months old, I went up to live with Ivan there. This was in 1930. And I went to Samurai. From there, I went on a small boat. And I had to sleep in a tent with Ivan on the bank of this river. And the sandflies were shocking, and I had this dear little baby, you see, and she scratched all night, and I scratched all night, and she cried all night. Then we started off in a canoe with an outboard motor, and the river flooded. And we went up about, I think, about a day, and then we had to come back again where we'd started from. And then we walked. And, of course, I wasn't prepared for walking. So I had shoes with high heels. I hadn't cut the heels off. And we carried this baby in it was a pram, but we covered it over with a net so that the leeches and sandflies wouldn't get on her. And I was covered in leeches all over my legs, and every now and again Arden would burn them with a cigarette or a match or something. And it took me 5 days to get to Yeoma with this little baby, feeding her every 3 hours. And I remember once we used to camp at night, if possible, And this night we came to a village. And as we came to the village, I heard this terrific coughing. And I said to Ivan, because living on a plantation, you learn a lot about medicine because you've got to be your own doctor, you know, when you're away from... And I knew this cough. I said, that's whooping cough. And I said, we can't stay here. And he said, well, where can go? I said, well, we've got to go somewhere, sleep in the bush, but you can't stay here. Got this little baby. So how far did we go on then, Ivan? Do you remember?
About two or three miles.
Anyway, we eventually arrived at Ioma. Well, the sad story of that was that after about the third day there, my little girl developed a high temperature. And I said, well, she's caught something on the way up. So she got so ill, we had to come back again. But of course, we floated down the river in no time because, you see, the river was going that way and there was no flood. So now I'm going to tell you the highlight of the whole story. We got back to Samurai and waiting for a boat to Port Moresby. And of course, this is many years ago. My daughter's 50, so it's 50 years ago. And there weren't many boats. And in came the Larrabana. And I was so delighted, and I thought, I can get back to Moresby with this sick little girl. Leonard Murray was the captain then, and he was the official secretary. So Mr. Atkinson went down, and he said, I've got Elsie Champion here. Now, don't forget that Leonard Murray had known me since a little girl. And he said, Elsie Champion's here, and she's got the little baby, and she's very sick. They want to get to Port Moresby quickly. He said, I can't take her. He said, why not? He said, I'm not having napkins hanging over the back of the Larrabana. And he refused to take me. That is a fact. I had to wait for the next boat, and I can't remember what that boat was. But we eventually got back to Port Moresby, and she was a very sick girl for many years.
Because of the frontier nature of life in Papua New Guinea, the administration preferred to recruit young, single men as patrol officers, and in the event of them getting married, discouraged them bringing their brides to Papua New Guinea. Mari Skinner, who spent the first 2 years of her married life in Australia separated from her patrol officer husband Ian, decided to take matters into her own hands.
I just made up my mind that I'd go up and have a look at the place. I went to Madang in September 1939, and I arrived in Madang one day, and the European war was declared the next. But my husband wasn't in Madang, he was down at Sidor, down the Rye coast, and he didn't know that I was coming. So my arrival wasn't very well greeted officially. The district officer sent for me and said that he now had these powers, because war had been declared, to take control of everything, and that meant getting rid of anyone that he didn't want there. It was another mouth to feed, as he said. So I was to return on the Bulolo to Sydney. And there was a friend of my husband's there, Ian Downs. Ian was a patrol officer. So I said to him that I didn't really think it was fair I'd come all that way to just go away again like that. I then arranged for a canoe, a native canoe, and I was rowed out onto one of the islands in the harbour of Madang. And I stayed there until the Bulolo sailed away. And then I came back. And then I had to face the district officer, who was quite furious with me and said that I knew that I was supposed to have got on that ship. Oh, he indicated that I couldn't expect no favours whatsoever as far as accommodation or anything like that was concerned. After Ian came in, he then had to go back again to his station, and then the district officer sent for me. And he said that he had told me he wouldn't give me accommodation, but he had decided that he would. And he said, there's a place, and his words were, it's been used by dogs and kanakas, but you might be able to do something with it. And I said, thank you very much, I'm quite sure I will.
In 1933, there were only 1,382 white women in all of Papua and New Guinea. They were outnumbered more than 2-1 by men. But in a masculine frontier world, many individual women were outstanding. Queen Emma and Elizabeth Marney ran plantations. There were the pioneer anthropologists, Margaret Mead, Hortense Powdermaker, and Beatrice Blackwood, the naturalist, Evelyn Cheeseman, and the novelist, Beatrice Grimshaw. They had their careers, but most women were there because of their husband's work. Their worries tended to centre on the home.
I'll never forget coming over the rise and seeing the house. Actually, it stood out like a cathedral. It had a huge high thatched roof. And actually, I fell in love with the sight of the place. But I was rather appalled when I got inside and saw how primitive it was. There were no doors. Eventually, I got some material and sewed them up by hand and put sand in the bottom to weight them down, and doorways were eventually covered with that. Our bed was a 16-legged bed. Des had managed to acquire four little occasional tables, all the one size, and put planks across it. And the only thing we owned was the double bed mattress, which he put on the top of this. So for quite some time, we had a 16-legged bed. But I think one of the hardest things, too, was there was no fresh food. Every single thing came out of a tin. And I think we used up our first whole year's wages in the first 4 months because I was opening so many tins every day and had no idea what I was doing. I'd never catered like this before. Eventually, we sort of took stock of ourselves and realised that we were overeating or overspending. The funniest thing was when our neighbours on a plantation about half a mile away, they got a refrigerator. And so we asked them if we could set a jelly and put it in their refrigerator. And we'd sit on the veranda late in the afternoon and send our cook boy with a note up to the Priestleys and saying, you know, please give him the jelly. And then we'd watch him, and we could see him running down the hill, disappearing down to cross the river at the bottom of the hill, up the other side, and we'd be sitting there poised with our spoons ready, waiting to have this jelly. That was our only cold food for 9 months. Our first stove was made out of stones and clay, and then I was highly delighted when Des went on patrol once and found an old army stove in the bush somewhere, and he brought that back and set that up on this platform in the kitchen. The handle on it was so old and rusted that I had to keep a big stone beside it, and I'd hammer the catch up, peer inside the oven with a torch, and then hammer the catch back again, making sure that my bread was rising.
We were supposed to have a bed every 3 months. We got one about every 5 months, and that did bring us flour and sugar, but only enough for 3 months. So for 2 months we were without both flour and sugar, which meant we couldn't make bread. We had to make all our own bread. We had no sugar. So we more or less lived on the land, on cow, which we dug up and cooked. The tops of the cow we cooked as a vegetable. We had green pawpaw, which we cooked as a vegetable. We had pineapples, pawpaws and bananas, which we could buy from the natives, and little tiny seed tomatoes the size of marbles, but at least we had those. We had Chinese cabbage, which we could get from the natives sometimes, and snake beans, and that was more or less our diet. We would get tinned meat in at times too.
We had a timber-built house with a grass roof. It was a place that rained a lot. It rained and rained and rained. Supplies were a problem. We didn't have any fridge. And I think the first year we only had a boat once every 3 months. So mail and food were very scarce. When we ordered supplies, most of the things we got were our ex-army. We used to get these cases and cases of tins. We had no idea what was in them because they had no labels on them. They had army code numbers on the top, which we didn't understand anyway, although my husband had a guess at some of them because he'd seen these things before. We had tins of dried egg powder and dried milk, and I can remember one particular shipment was a whole case of tins of parsnips, tins of quinces, and most of them were not exactly fresh. But we made do.
We'd have fowl and there'd be pigeons, and Dad also had the natives build a fish trap down round the corner of the island. It was like a big fence, but there was one opening, I think, under the other, and they'd get in and they wouldn't know how to get out. And many a time Dad's got about six big parrotfish and told them the others were too small and throw them back and let them grow.
The culture shock for young brides suddenly transplanted from city to New Guinea outstation life could be profound. Often they arrived in remote locations, as Teresa Bloxham did at Itape, to find their husbands had to go off for long periods of time on patrol, leaving them to cope with the management of staff and the general running of the station. Unable to speak pidgin English and fearful of possibly hostile blacks, Mrs. Bloxham asked for one of her husband's revolvers in case of trouble during his absence.
I got into bed and thought I would have an early night. I tried to read and that was hopeless, so I felt under my pillow for this revolver. Every sound worried me, and I thought, well, now, shall I cock it or shall I not? If I cock it, it will be ready. But isn't it too dangerous? And I thought, oh, would it shoot through a wall? I couldn't make sure whether the bullet would go through the wall or not if it went off by mistake. So in the end, I decided not to cock it, but I put it back to normal. It was about 10 o'clock, and I was just feeling that I could settle down when I heard a thumping sound coming along the veranda, this slap, slap, slap of naked feet, you see. And I heard the rattle of a rifle, and I heard a voice call out, Mrs. Kerr, you stop. I was quite silent for a time. I thought, I wonder who this is. And then I thought, well, it must be the boy who was looking after me. I called out, who's that? And he said, me, Booker. Man belong look out him, you. He was quite happy about this fact that I had spoken to him, and he marched off. I could hear his footsteps disappear at the back. Well, this was very good, but I thought, well, now, he'll be there till morning, and no one will come near me. And at midnight, when I had actually fallen asleep, the footsteps came again, slap, slap, slap along the veranda, and the thud of a rifle. Mrs. Kerr, you stop. And I was beginning to feel rather doubtful about this going on. I put the light on and it was midnight. And I thought, good heavens, I'm not going to get any sleep at all. So away he went. Apparently he was satisfied. And I rolled about restlessly and eventually sort of dozed and woke up and dozed. 2 o'clock, he'd come every 2 hours solemnly. And I didn't know how to explain to him that he mustn't keep coming to wake me up, because this was worse than looking after me almost. So it was 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock. I woke up just as the light filtered through the blinds. And I thought, oh, thank heaven for that. So out of my bed I got, and just as I was about to get dressed, or go to the bathroom actually, I heard this sound again. It was his 6 o'clock rally. He'd come again and couldn't find me this time, you see. He called out, Mrs., you stop? And I heard a voice in the distance, but didn't take much notice. I thought it was the boys who'd come back up to the house. Well, the poor boy was frantic. Apparently, I wasn't there. And he got hold of every boy he could find around. He got Sandman, he got the monkeys, to rush through the house to try to find out where I was. I hadn't realised the reactions that had taken place and how frantic my poor watchman was. And to get out of their way, I took myself off and shut myself in the bathroom. Well, of course, this made the situation worse. And it wasn't until they came hammering at the bathroom door, which was even worse as far as I was concerned, that they found where I was. And the policeman who was looking after me was not satisfied until he heard my voice. So I had to talk to him through the bathroom door. And after that, all was well. Well, this was my initiation, really, into this sort of way of living. Because when I was a little bit more used to things, I knew how to cope with it. But it was a sort of panic station situation, really, although I don't think I'm in the habit of panicking. But it was something that I didn't know how to contend with. And this, of course, was just one thing out of many.
Sickness and the fear of sickness were constant worries for women with young children. Before they had access to modern drugs and advice by radio, the women could do little to combat illness. The medicines recommended by the government medical officer, Dr. Strong, in 1912 for all outstations were next to useless in most emergencies. Carbolic acid, boric acid, tablets of zinc sulfate, turpentine, liniment, bluestone, quinine, Dover's powders, Epsom salts, Eastern syrup, Livingston rouses, whatever they were, and so on. They were a mixture of the helpful the harmful and the useless. The quinine was recommended, not to prevent malaria, but to combat the disease after the patient had actually developed the fever. Blackwater fever, probably a complication of malaria, was a mystery to the doctors. They advised giving the patient a dose of salts and making him sweat. In general, the pre-war population had to learn to live with fever.
The fever was terrible. Terrible fever. There'd be six of us, all in bed at once. And Mr. Riley, he'd had some medical experience, but he really wasn't a doctor. And he used to give us Warburg tincture tablets, but they had to be taken with brandy, which I hated. But incidentally, I think my dosage was about four, and an adult had to take six to make you perspire. And I can remember that from tossing my head from side to side, my long hair got into a great big mat. And Dad said, look, there's nothing for it, Mother, but cut it off. He said, you can't do anything with that. And I cried and I cried. So my eldest sister came in with a bottle of methylated spirits and a comb and a brush. And she said, don't you worry, Aim, I'll get the knots out. And she sat there, it must have been for 2 hours, and she unmatted all of that hair.
There was no doctor in the district when I was there. My mother used to go out every morning. Father would go down and, it was called fall in the boys and sort them into gangs to go out on the plantation, and any that reported sick were sent up to the house, where Mother received them attired in the most beautiful Japanese dressing gown with purple stalks on it. And she would minister to them, and she had a fairly limited medicine chest. She had Epsom salts, which was a great standby. Practically any disease would respond to Epsom salts. Castor oil, iodine, bluestone, you mixed up and bathed things with, and white bandages. They were a wonderful cure for anything. So they were doled out rather sparsely. But she dealt with teeth and mumps and sore heads and upset stomachs and snake bite and anything else with an impartial hand. Snake bite, you had a clean razor blade in a box and permanganate of potash, and she'd slash away at a, when a boy came in with a snake bite, slash away at the two little holes and dob on the permanganate of potash and send him away and he'd recover. She was a standing woman.
It was very, very difficult when we were way up in that cold area because they got pneumonia very, very quickly. Many of the nights we've sat up with the antiphlogiston plasters and the eggnog and the brandy and hoping to God he wouldn't die during the night, because if a native died and you hadn't got him to hospital, you're for the high jump. The administration would take a very, very dim view of saying, why didn't you get him to hospital? Well, it was a long way. You daren't move him when the crisis, until the crisis had passed, otherwise you could have killed him.
You had to have a lot of explanations as to, you know, as to whether you'd really tried to get them there in time.
We didn't know when we went in there that amoebic dysentery had come into the Highlands, and my baby became very ill. And then my other child, he got a tetanus from working down in the gardens. He used to like to go down there with the native women when they were working in the gardens, and only had a small cut on his finger. But we were alerted to the symptoms because a week or so before, a young patrol officer died with tetanus in that Eastern Highlands area, so we were very conscious of it being there. So when David started with these symptoms, my husband got on to a doctor on the coast, but our weather was so bad we couldn't get a plane in, and so we just had to hang on this phone and follow his directions. Then he had one actual spasm, a locking of the jaw, and the doctor said, well, in so many hours' time you'll know whether you're treatment has been satisfactory or not. If it happened again, that was it. So we just had to wait that out. And at that time I was in this little house, and I had about 8 people there who were stranded there waiting on aeroplanes. No, and I was trying to feed them and look after them, and I had this terribly, desperately sick little boy. So you went through all that very traumatic experience when you had small children in those areas.
The stark reality of sickness and medical emergencies had to be faced. there was also a less tangible fear, or fantasy, of sexual attack on the few white women in Papua New Guinea by black men. In reality, this hardly ever happened, but the feeling that it might was ever present.
In those days, the administration put out a little booklet, the guides for a white woman going to the territory. And I don't remember too much about it, but I know we had to dress conservatively, no shorts. We could wear long slacks, and you didn't sit up in bed and have morning tea with a flimsy nightdress on. The veneer of civilization is very thin with those people, and you were particularly careful in your behavior with them, which was a very good idea for newcomers.
Consequently, we had practically no trouble at all with natives in our day in New Guinea. It was most unusual for us to have any trouble with natives then, different from today.
I had a very good dog. I lived in isolated places, and the best protection you can have is a good blue heeler dog.
Oh, I was always very careful. And I spent many months or weeks here alone on the plantation when John was in the house and being out on the labour land. But I've never had anything but the utmost respect from them. But I do think if you wear shorts up round your navel and get around in a bikini or something, these people are only natural. And the primitive male is no different, really, from a lot of our own sort of educated, sophisticated European males.
The Papuans and New Guineans that most white women came closest to were the household servants. In fact, many women rarely had a chance to speak to a Papua New Guinean who wasn't a servant. But the largely unwritten laws about avoiding sexual excitement and how best to deal with servants stopped many white women from ever knowing Papuans and New Guineans as ordinary people. From Fanny laws in the 1870s through to the 1960s, the white women were restrained by the expectation that they would set standards of moral propriety and domestic efficiency.
I noticed the fact that everybody had a servant, that everybody's house was spotlessly clean, which was very strange. You never saw a dirty house or an untidy house because the houses were all looked after by somebody else.
Well, I loved the gardening, not that I had to do the manual work myself. We certainly had wonderful staff. We never ran our house less than four in the house. They were big homes, most of them old-fashioned German type of bungalows. It sounds a lot of servants to have in a home, but you have your cook and you have your laundryman, and then you have a couple of others that do the general household chores, because they don't do everything like the normal servant might do in Australia, or as they would in those days, not in these present day. I'm not talking about present day. I'm talking about long ago. But it was necessary for you to have your cook and your laundress, because you did your laundry every day and that sort of thing. You had to supervise them all the time. And despite the fact that they may be good many times, but they're not like an Australian servant.
Well, they were very, very cheap. In the 50s and 60s, I think we paid them about £3 a month with their accommodation, food, clothing, tobacco. They worked long hours, very long hours, but they didn't seem to mind.
For a start, you had the boy and maybe another girl out there to help you. You didn't have to run in and out to your kitchen, so you spent a lot of time setting your table as nicely as you could with all your best crockery and silver and crystal. Yes, we lived graciously. If you wanted the boy to bring in the next course, you had a little bell that you could ring, and so the dishes were taken out and the next course brought in. I suppose very gracious living.
Well, as a matter of fact, in our early days at Rigo, my wife was rather concerned at the fact that we didn't have a butter knife, a silver butter knife. And we ordered butter knives to be sent, and we still didn't really use the butter knife. It was put on the table each evening, but we would just simply use our bread knife. But Phil didn't want the boy to think that we didn't use a butter knife, so she would always religiously get the butter knife and scrape it over the butter. We didn't use it, but...
You had to do that. If he thought, that's not being used, don't put that on the table. So if you want him always to set the table properly, you just had to show him that that was used every time.
A lot of women had servant trouble. We didn't have any servant trouble. We were very lucky. You had to learn to show them what you wanted to do. And then quite often they did it a different way. And so it was a good idea if you learned to like it the way they did it anyway. Otherwise you'd do it yourself. But I found that basically a lot of people came up there, ordinary working people, and they, to me, it seemed as if they'd never been able to take an order and they didn't know how to give one, and their relationships weren't very happy.
They polish. Oh, you can see your face in the floors, the way they polish, and put the polish on, and then the coconut husk they rub it off with, and they do that every day. That you can hardly walk on the floors, they're beautiful. They're quite good, really. And potatoes, they don't say potatoes, it's butter tea. They can't pronounce the P, they say butter tea. You one fella, two fella, three fella, butter tea. And you tell them how many you want done, you see. But oh, they love you to have a dinner party, because if you have quite, which you do, you have quite a few people returning hospitality of all the places you've been. Then, oh, they scrape everything into one dish, the sweets and everything, and oh, they think that's just about it, but it's just a horrible mess, I think.
Now, I can remember once I asked the boy to put in some, his name was Upper, and I asked Upper to put in some starch into my husband's shirts. Well, his idea of starch was he starched the underpants, he starched the handkerchiefs, he starched everything inside, and the tea towels. And it was very difficult to explain to him, because he'd really worked hard on doing this.
When I first arrived in New Guinea and had to get used to mixing up powdered milk to drink and getting used to native servants too, which I'd never had in my life, I'd mixed up some milk this morning, and I, because the house was open, there were no flyaway windows or anything like that, I decided I needed something to cover this milk up. So I said to the boy that was in the kitchen, would you get me a cover? I said it in pidgin, for the milk, lap lap belang susu. And I was amazed to see him walk towards the bedroom, and he came back a few moments later bearing a bra. Susu can also mean a woman's breast as well as milk, and this was his interpretation of a cover for it.
They still will do exactly what you say. But I can remember now, this is going back nearly 30 years ago, when we first came up here, Mum said to the boy to get a cockerel, a chook. She wanted him to get a chook and kill it and pluck it so we could cook it for tea that night. Well, her pigeon not being very well, you know, she said, kiss him, cockerel, and rouse him, feather, and put him long block of sauce. So Mum had it in the fridge about 5 hours later, and here's a chook without a feather on it, alive, sitting in the fridge, and you have never seen anything like it in all your life. And the boy did exactly what she said, but he didn't kill it. I'll never forget that. She went off her brain. How stupid and all the rest of it. But he did what she told him to.
Well, this story concerns a dinner party and the trouble that people used to go to have something different. And this woman had ordered a sucking pig from Moresby. And she'd explained to her cook boy just how it had to be cooked and how it should be dressed to bring to the table. And she said, now, you understand that you put a lemon in the mouth and parsley in the ears. Yes, miss, yes, missus, he said. And so the guests were assembled and everyone was sitting down, and in on a great silver salver came the pig and also the boy with a mouth stretched wide with a lemon in his mouth and two sprigs of parsley out of his ears.
There were always the people who thought nothing of hitting them or yelling at them. I couldn't do those sort of things. And that's why I often felt I was the wrong sort of person to be there when I felt like that. You used to become very frustrated with some of the things that they did, but I was always able to think, well, they're in an alien situation when they're dealing with us and our way of doing things, and I was able to see it that way.
Well, I don't think they enjoyed working for Europeans ever. What they did want, of course, was cash in order to buy the various things that were available in the trade stores. Certainly, Papua New Guineans didn't like working for women, or at least the majority of them certainly didn't. And remember, all the domestic servants were men. There were very, very few women in domestic service. But for some Papua New Guineans, certainly domestic service was more attractive than cutting copra on a plantation or working on the roads and things of this kind. The hours were long, but the work wasn't nearly as hard. I know many households where the chief cook or the chief houseboy, boy is a word I object to, but where the chief servant, shall I say, was an old retainer, and where there was a very good relationship between a householder and the old servant. In fact, he was very often privileged and could say things which would have caused anyone else to be knocked down. Often, too, those people were pensioned off late in life. Nevertheless, the attitude of the Europeans to even the faithful retainer were very patronising. They were treated like Uncle Joes.
There were some very few women wouldn't have servants at all because they just couldn't face paying whatever the going rate was, which was about $7 or $8 a week, maybe even a fortnight, and having a man do the work. It just didn't seem right to them. I mean, you wouldn't have a man in Australia doing your housework for you. Why would you have a man up there?
It sometimes seemed that the one thing all white women in the Territory had in common were stories about servants. They varied, of course, in the way they told them, sometimes with understanding and occasionally with scorn. For Papua New Guineans, one of the commonest experiences for those who entered the cash economy was to work in a white household. In the 1930s, there were over 5,000 men working as domestic servants. Little wonder, then, that even in the smallest coastal village, it's often possible to find a man who talks of a missus or seen about her as his one-time boss. One irony is that in the district known as the home of the most efficient house servants, the local term for a lazy woman, is now the same as for a white woman. In the 1960s, the domestic servants freed many Australian women to take paid jobs. Some went to the air-conditioned offices and specialised shops, even boutiques. But earlier, the wife recently arrived from Australia was uncertain just what she should do.
If you like the social round of women, it was a tremendous life. In the early days, when we first went there, there were morning teas every morning and usually afternoon teas, and a couple of afternoons a week you play mahjong, and all there'd be bridge for. Sometimes you go out to bridge at night as well. It was just an endless round of chit-chat, actually, and it got on my nerves. I never really was geared for that kind of thing.
And then you had your garden and your animals. I had a big poultry, always had lots of poultry. And then the offices closed at 4 o'clock and we played tennis or played golf. We didn't have much in the way of nighttime entertainment because there was no one else about. The only entertainment one had you made yourself from your little gramophone and so on.
A man can go out, he has his work, it's interesting, and the woman stays home. I was lucky, I was able to go on patrol at times and so on, but most women are more or less confined to their house. And the white woman in New Guinea doesn't undertake to do the domestic work. This isn't because she's unwilling, but the climate just wasn't suitable for women to be hanging over a wood stove in that temperature or in that wet heat. I think that most of them were satisfied with playing cards or reading, perhaps writing letters home, but a lot of them just lived in a little tiny field of their own, a little tiny closed-in community.
Well, it depends entirely on the woman. You get people who try and reproduce as nearly as they can the suburb they came from in Australia. In their life around here, they're frightened to step outside of that. Others come with a sense of adventure and want to go and do things and see the country and get to know local people and visit villages. So you get all sorts. For a woman, life is what she makes it. I mean, the CWA in Moresby, for instance, was a very big thing. Lots of women there. They did a very, very necessary job in supplying needs for particularly the outside women who came in and helping. But of course they had to raise money, so they had their staff at home to run the house and do the washing up, and they spent their time raising money by turning on morning teas every day for all the local business people came and had morning tea at the CWA hut that was lent to them, and they did the washing up. And they all got together and enjoyed it. But I always used to tease them and say, well, really, you do love washing up, don't you? And same with running things to raise money. They ran preschools using themselves on a roster as voluntaries and Girl Guide leaders. And again, it depends on the person. If they're not inclined to bestir themselves, they'd be bored and dull. They also played a lot of bridge and golf and things like that. And they all, ones that lacked acting, it was really a very active society. People really made use of the fact that they had somewhere else to do the housework and then doing the things they'd always wanted to do.
I used to go and teach the women how to sew and give them cooking lessons. I even had them up to the house and taught them how to set a table and wait on a table, because I thought by this time a lot of the men of New Guinea were becoming education officers and, you know, in the House of Assembly, but the women were always left behind. And I felt somebody had to teach the women how to keep up with the men. And so I'd have them up at the residency and sit them down at a table and set it all out properly and explain to them how to use a knife and fork and all this sort of thing.
In many cases, Australian women, particularly the wives of administration officers, were unpaid servants of the government, providing food and lodging for visiting officials in areas where there were no hotels or indeed any alternative accommodation. Most women were in New Guinea because of their husbands' careers. Not only did they make the best of difficult situations, but their contribution to the development of the country is largely unrecorded.
At one stage, I went for 9 months without seeing a white woman. That may sound strange. And when I did eventually go into Rabaul to come on leave, I was very jittery and very dithery. And I was scared of the cars that were racing round Rabaul. And here today, I drive a car anywhere. And I lost a lot of weight because I had a lot of fever. But it didn't take away from me any of my love for the country or its people or with the work that my husband did. I had married him, and therefore that's where I stayed, and I loved him, and I loved the country that I was living in.
In Wife and Mrs., you heard the voices of Pin Champion, Jean Huxley, Mari Skinner, Jean Ashton, Jean Gibbs, Elma Holmes, Amy Washington, Teresa Bloxham, Penelope Hope, Billy Burke, Eileen Bulmer, Edith Watts, Amira Inglis, Jean McCarthy, Phil Lindsley, Gordon Lindsley, Pat Hopper, Andre Millar, Gladys Stevens, Nolene Shaw, Shirley Taylor, Ginny Williams, Ian Hoban, and Dame Rachel Clearland. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, Fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.